Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, the Moon, the Sun, and all the other things we know about our solar system that we were taught since we were kids. But now, I'm hyped about TRAPPIST-1? Have you ever heard of it? Everyone I asked that question in prepping for this episode gave me two answers. And let me just say that one of those answers was not a yes. To the question of, have you heard of TRAPPIST-1? I got either no or TRAPPIST-1? But it's okay. I'm not gonna let you kill my buzz because hey, you don't know what you don't know until you know it and then you know it. So let me hopefully get you hyped about TRAPPIST-1.
Podcast presented by Sonic Embassy.
Episode 08, Milky Way Marvels, TRAPPIST-1. Welcome to Milky Way Marvels. It's an ongoing series in which we explore various wonders of our galaxy. Like many of you, I don't really pay attention to space discoveries. I mean, I do, but I don't. Like, I love astronomy, but I don't hardcore follow it. But sometimes a new discovery hits my eyes or ears and it really catches my attention. And that's what happened with TRAPPIST-1. One of the things that really gets me hyped is when new discoveries are announced, but not just any discovery, mainly the announcements of new planets, especially exoplanets. A what planet? Exoplanet? Like hug kiss planet? I wish. Earth needs to be a planet of XOXO right about now. But no, in this case, it's an EXO planet. An exoplanet is an extrasolar planet, a planet orbiting a different star than our sun, pretty much a planet outside of our solar system. At this moment, there are more than 4,000 known exoplanets. And there are thousands of others that are unconfirmed and require further study, meaning we think they exist, we just need to stare at them more. Scientists say that in the Milky Way galaxy, there are in fact more planets than there are stars. Isn't that crazy? But I guess when you think about it, our solar system has one star, the sun, but has 9 planets. So I guess I can see how that could be the case. Kind of like in my house, I'm outnumbered 4-1. Except in this case, they are the stars and I'm just a gas giant. So how are exoplanets discovered? I mean, I can't just get some binoculars, go outside, and be very, very, very still and very, very patient and not blink and finally catch sight of a planet dot around a dot of light in the night sky. Here is Dr. Pamela Gay, senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute and the podcast Astronomy Cast, along with Fraser Kane, explaining a few methods on how exoplanets are found.
So the ways that we're finding planets today range from purposeful to, there's a planet. And I just love the fact that we're now accidentally finding planets. So just like when we had this first conversation, you can find planets by looking at bright stars using high resolution spectrographs and looking for the little tiny motions that are indicative of a planet slowly moving its star around the mutual center of mass. And the amount of motion that we're seeing, you could run faster than these stars are moving. So it's not a huge movement. And this is where you need bright stars that we can really spread their light out. We can make really accurate measurements of what's called the radial velocities, the rate at which the star is moving towards us and away from us. Now, in order to find planets using the radial velocity method, you need to have a planet that is passing between us and the star. It can be a little higher, a little lower than the star. So this method allows you to find stars that are transiting and that would transit if only they were closer to their star or their angle was tilted just a little bit more. It does not let us find the planets that are going around the star in the plane of the sky relative to us.
Radial velocity method, like a galactic tug of war between the star and the planet. So scientists look for the wobble, so to speak.
The initial way that people found planets was they looked for the Doppler shifting of regular everyday stars by hot Jupiters. And because the gravitational pull of a planet will indeed yank around its sun, we measured those motions the same way a police officer measures if you're speeding or not, by seeing how light coming from the star gets shifted redwards or bluewards in its motion.
So no doubt, this way is not a flawless way to find planets.
With the radial velocity method, we are limited to finding planets that are moving towards us and away from us in the plane of the sky. This means ideally we can only find things that, first of all, are big enough to yank their star around, and second of all, are close enough that they're big enough has an effect. And you have to have the geometry where they're moving in and out towards and away from us in the plane of the sky. Okay, so that's all annoying and limits what we're able to see.
There is another method used today that I find really intriguing, and one used in the discoveries of TRAPPIST-1.
So we have the radial velocity that uses ground-based telescopes, large spectrographs, and can only really work with bright stars. The other method that we have is looking for transiting planets. This is when a planet passes in front of its star, causing the star's light to dim slightly. This is something that you can do with a backyard telescope if your backyard happens to have really good sky conditions. What you need is the perfect sky that isn't fluctuating and twinkling all over the place, and really, really, really well-calibrated equipment. You don't need big equipment. You need well-calibrated equipment so you can look for that fraction of a percent dip in the star's light.
Man, this sounds so cool. I really need to get me a really, really good telescope.
This was initially done mostly with stars that we knew had planets going around and around them. And after people with like 4-inch driveway telescopes started being able to replicate planet results, well, we launched this little spacecraft that just might have been called Kepler, and we started pulling in planets 1,000 at a time, potential planets 1,000 at a time. And since then, we've been going through confirming them using the Doppler technique, and sometimes even, well, lately we've found a tiny, tiny handful of planets by looking directly for them. We're looking for tiny, tiny, tiny dips, sometimes just a tenth of a percent of light in the light from a star. And this is something we've only been able to do for the past couple of decades.
So I'm wondering what some limitations of this method are.
Now, with the transit method, it gets even worse. With the transit method, we have to have the planet precisely aligned so that it passes in front of its star, eclipsing some of the light from the star relative to us, which means the alignment has to be not just in and out of the sky, but precisely so that it's not tilted up or down too much. Even in our own solar system, we don't see Venus and Mercury regularly eclipsing our sun. If we only catch Venus every few generations having a pair of transits, how much rarer is it going to be to see alien planets transiting their stars? Well, it turns out it's pretty common, but it still limits what we can see.
If you go to exoplanets.nasa.gov and look up 5 ways to find a planet, you can see how many exoplanets have been discovered using each of these methods. So using methods like this have led to my new fascination with TRAPPIST-1. What is TRAPPIST-1? TRAPPIST-1 is the name of a star, an ultra-cool red dwarf star that's maybe a little bit bigger than Jupiter. It's about 40 light years from Earth, or 235 trillion miles, or 12 parsecs. Hit the like button if you first heard about a parsec from a Star Wars movie. Just me, huh? Liars. If you find the constellation Aquarius, TRAPPIST-1 will be in there. But don't expect to walk outside tonight and see it. Well, at least not with your naked eyes. But more on that in a bit. It was discovered in 1999 by University of Delaware physics and astronomy professor John Geizes and colleagues. It was originally called 2-mass J23062928-0502285. I don't know about you, but I like the name TRAPPIST-1 better. But more on the newer name in a bit, too. So, TRAPPIST-1 is a star, and just like human beings, there is a lot of diversity among the stars. There are many different types of stars. We often use our sun as the measure of reference for other types. Often they are classified into 7 types based on their temperature. So there are neutron stars, pulsars, giant stars, red giants, blue giants, supergiants. There are dwarf stars, white dwarfs, brown dwarfs, yellow dwarfs like our sun. And there are red dwarfs like TRAPPIST-1. Red dwarfs are the most common type of star found in our galaxy. In fact, about 3/4 of the stars are estimated to be red dwarfs. So, what is a red dwarf? Well, again, let's use the star we know the most about as our reference point, the Sun. Although considered a dwarf star as well, it's like a giant compared to a red dwarf.
A red dwarf is a tiny star. We're talking these things are on average at least 40% the size of the sun, if not smaller. They do come a bit larger. And in fact, there's a lot of argument over exactly where you draw the line at the top of what the size of a red dwarf is. At the bottom, these are the smallest objects capable of prolonged hydrogen burning via the proton-proton chain deep in their core.
And like the sun, yellow dwarfs are hotter, give off more energy, and a yellowish or whitish color, all making it more bright, easier to see. A red dwarf is relatively cool, which means they give off less energy and a red color, all making it more less bright.
It all comes down to what kind of star is it. I don't know about you, but I have incandescent lights in my house in random places still because I'm a bad human being. And I know that the 100-watt light bulbs, if I touch those suckers too soon, totally going to burn myself. Whereas the lower wattage bulbs, the not turned up all the way on the fader bulbs, if I want to replace those with a fluorescent bulb, I just turn them off and grab them and it's good. Stars, it's the same way. If they're big, they're hot, they're gonna get rid of all of the water and burn that planet. You have a smaller, redder, cooler star, and water can be liquid, but not boil away. These stars also go through a different kind of launching into existence, whereas a red dwarf, it's going to be an angry little X-ray jettisoning object for a while, but it's not going to go through that prolonged period of being super hot.
So that's why you can't see TRAPPIST-1 or probably any red dwarf star in the night sky without a really powerful telescope, which is really unfortunate. I would really love to go outside and stare at TRAPPIST-1 and daydream, or nightdream, about what's there. So, what is there? And why am I so excited about it? Well, in 2016, a team of astronomers at the University of Liège in Belgium had been observing the star 2-mass J23062928-0502285. Now, even though they were in Belgium, they were using a robotic telescope in La Silla, Chile, called Transiting Planets and Planetesimals Small Telescope, SOUTH, or TRAPPIST-SOUTH. It's a Belgian telescope. They discovered 2 planets orbiting 2-mass J23062928-0502285. the discovery is huge. Not only are they the first planets ever discovered around such a tiny and dim star, but also they are Earth-like, meaning both are similar in size to Earth, are rock balls, not gas balls, and incredibly similar in temperature to Earth. This launches an intensive follow-up and non-stop observation. So now this star, 2-mass J23062928-0502285, is now a star system or planetary system and is renamed TRAPPIST-1. Thank you. And the name TRAPPIST is not just named for that telescope.
Nestled in a valley of Belgium's Ardennes mountain range, an almost 900-year-old monastery known as Orville Abbey. Trappist monks have been brewing beer here since the 12th century.
Now, this world-famous Trappist monastic beer has inspired the name of one of the most extraordinary astronomical finds ever.
Trappist is the nickname of a system of seven Earth-sized planets orbiting a dwarf star just 40 light-years away. Erin McLaughlin, CNN, Liège, Belgium.
Clever. You know, beer goes with everything. I wonder which came first, the name idea or the idea for the acronym. And it's like, here's what we want the acronym to be. Now let's come up with a clever name for each letter so it makes sense. Perhaps the beer came first. But as you heard in that clip, in 2017, they discovered five more planets orbiting TRAPPIST-1 for a grand total of seven. Here is Thomas Zurbuggen of the NASA Science Mission Directorate in February of 2017.
I'm excited to announce today that Dr. Michael Gion and his team have used our Spitzer Space Telescope to determine that there are actually seven Earth-sized planets orbiting the nearby TRAPPIST-1 star about 40 light years away. What's more is that three of these planets are in the habitable zone where liquid water can pool on the surface. In fact, with the right atmospheric conditions, there could be water on any of these planets. So for the first time, we found as many terrestrial planets around a single star, and that's the first time we have been able to measure, in addition to that, both the masses and the radii of these habitable zone-type Earth-sized planets. These planets are among the best of all the planets we know to follow up, to see, for example, with the James Webb Space Telescope that we're going to launch last year, the atmospheres, and also to look at biosignatures, if there are any. The discovery gives us a hint that finding a second Earth is not just a matter of if, but when.
These new five exoplanets they discovered, just like the first two, are all Earth-like. And three of them are in the habitable zone. In other words, like Mother Earth, they are at a distance from their sun in which liquid water could exist. The discovery sets a new record for the greatest number of habitable zone planets found around a single star outside our solar system. How do they figure out that these planets are like this?
What gets me is how they're figuring this out. We can't exactly directly image the surface of these worlds yet because we haven't spent the money to build those telescopes yet. I'm really hoping we'll get there. But right now, what ends up happening is we have these worlds are getting discovered by Kepler, and there's a whole bunch of them. Kepler-62e is one of the ones that gets the most attention, but there's a whole bunch of these different worlds, and we can observe them transiting in front of their stars. So we know how quickly they're moving in their orbit. We are able to see how long it takes them to dim. And so you have your object, and as it passes in front of the star, it takes time for it to go from completely beside the star to completely in front of the star. And that amount of time that it takes it to move also gives us the width of the planet. So with these transiting systems, we have the ability to physically measure the size of the planet if it's the right kind of dip. Once we know how big the world is, we know how it's orbiting, we can start making assumptions about what its mass is, and then the modelers are free to model. And they plug into their computers. Well, you throw these things in, assuming, okay, if the star has this composition, the solar nebula would have had this composition. And in the models, it works out what elements would have gotten blasted to the outer solar system during planetary formation, what elements would have been left behind, what should this world have been made of. And it appears that to get the sizes we're seeing, you need a world covered in water.
So let's paint the picture of what the TRAPPIST-1 system looks like. And of course, let's use what we know best, which is our own solar system, to make it make sense. You know how our sun is really huge? Like, compared to Earth, they say a million plus Earths could fit inside the sun. And you know how Jupiter is really huge to our other planets? And they estimate that just 1,000 Jupiters can fit inside the sun. And 1,300 plus Earths could fit inside Jupiter. Now the star TRAPPIST-1 is about the size of Jupiter, maybe a bit bigger. So hopefully that gives you a mental picture of the sizes. Okay, now let's talk orbits and proximity. If you picture drawing a line representing each planet's orbit around the sun, and it would make a circle around the sun, starting with Mercury, then you go out a little bit further and you trace the path of Venus around the sun, go out a bit further, trace Earth's path with the line, a bit further for Mars, go way out for Jupiter, etc. Then, if you look at it from above, all the orbits would look like the rings of a tree, or the ripples when you drop a pebble into a pond. I think it's safe to say that we consider Mercury to be pretty darn close to the sun. But check this out. All 7 of TRAPPIST-1's known planets are closer to their sun than Mercury is to ours. Isn't that nuts when you think about it? All 7 planets' orbit lines could fit inside Mercury's orbit line. The planets in our system are in, like, a rural countryside. Nice and peaceful, elegant. We'll get around the sun when we get there. And in TRAPPIST-1, they're bunched up and huddled together like a downtown rush hour.
Excuse me, trying to get around the sun here.
Trying to get around the sun.
Get around the sun.
It's even been likened more to how Jupiter system's moons orbit so close.
If you were on the surface of one of these planets, you would have a wonderful view on the other planets. You wouldn't see them we see Venus or Mars, like dots of light. But you would see them really as we see the moon. You would see worlds which are very big. You could see the structures on these worlds. They would be as large as the moon, and even larger for some of them. So it would be a wonderful view on these planets.
That would be so cool, just like in sci-fi. Art imitating life, imitating art. In a moment, what do we know so far about the TRAPPIST-1 planets? And what's the future of study for this interesting star system?
Nostalgia lovers.
From the award-winning producers at Sonic Embassy comes an all-new podcast mini-series that takes a fun, entertaining look on various nouns and popular culture.
It's pop culture icons.
I like them because everyone hates them.
So what was it about SpongeBob that you liked?
What made me like it was just the title.
I have a love-hate relationship with Batman.
Pop culture icons.
We're taking you back.
Podcast presented by Sonic Embassy.
Now streaming everywhere you listen.
Milky Way Marvels.
So what do we know about TRAPPIST-1? What are some of the details of the planets? It's too early for names just yet, so all the planets are labeled TRAPPIST-1 B, C, D, E, F, G, and H in order of increasing distance from their parent star. So, like Mercury, the first rock from its sun would be TRAPPIST-1 B. So again, with all that nonstop observation, what do we know? Here's Michel Guillon, one of the Belgian astronomers who first made this discovery at that NASA press conference in February of 2017.
Well, we have measured with Spitzer very, very precisely the sizes. And furthermore, we have, thanks to Spitzer too, preliminary measurements of the masses for six of them. And for one of them, our measurement is precise enough to strongly suggest a water-rich composition, which is very exciting because this is one of the planets in the habitable zone. Furthermore, these planets are orbiting so close to the star that they must be, or they are probably, tidally locked, which means they always face the star with the same side, like the Moon to the Earth, with a permanent day side and a permanent night side. The TRAPPIST-1 planet could be just like this. So ultra-cool dwarfs are known to be very active when they are young, and this is the main concern about these potentially habitable planets, that they could have been the atmosphere being eroded strongly by the star when it was young. Now it's quiet. It's a quiet ultra-cool dwarf, so it's not very active. But maybe when it was young, the conditions were quite different. So it will be by observation that we will really figure out the past of this planet and what happened during this very active and young phase.
Yeah, so the atmospheres of planets tell us a great deal about the formation and evolution of planets, and also about all of the physical processes that are occurring on the planet's surface and in the air, especially those that might make the planet habitable or actually indicative of hosting life. We can use space-based telescopes today to study the atmospheres of planets using a technique called transmission spectroscopy, which detects the fingerprints of different chemical species in a planet's air, such as water or methane, ozone or oxygen. We're currently using the Hubble Space Telescope to study the planets in the TRAPPIST-1 system to determine if they have hydrogen-helium dominated atmospheres. It's actually great to find out if they don't. That gives us another push forward in having these planets be, in fact, rocky, and also the potential of those planets to support water on their surfaces. Just last year, Hubble actually probed the innermost planets of the TRAPPIST-1 system, TRAPPIST B and C, and found that they didn't have hydrogen-helium-dominated atmospheres. So that's just one more step along the path to having these potentially habitable worlds.
And that was Nicole Lewis, astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore.
So I'll use Eyes on Exoplanets here to give you a brief tour of the habitable zone of the TRAPPIST-1 system. So if we zoom out to the system away from the host star, you'll see all seven planets. The innermost planet in the habitable zone is TRAPPIST-1e. So in this illustration, you'll see an artist's rendition of TRAPPIST-1e, which is a really interesting planet for a number of reasons. It's very close in size to Earth. It also receives about the same amount of light as Earth does in our own solar system. This means that in TRAPPIST-1e, you could have temperatures that are very, very similar to the ones that we have here on Earth. The next planet out is TRAPPIST-1f. Now, this is a potentially water-rich world that is, again, about the same size as Earth. Now, TRAPPIST-1f has about a 9-day orbit, and during that time, it receives about the same amount of sunlight as Mars does in our own solar system. And the final planet in the habitable zone of the TRAPPIST-1 system is TRAPPIST-1g. Now, TRAPPIST-1g is the largest planet in the TRAPPIST-1 system. It's about 13% larger radius than that of Earth, and it receives about the same amount of starlight as somewhere in between Mars and the asteroid belt in our own solar system.
We're hearing a lot of talk about that, quote, habitable zone, but...
Yeah, so according to NASA, which means that this number could be out of date because I'm looking on a NASA website and it's hard to keep these websites up to date. Last this website was updated, Kepler alone had found 30 exoplanets less than twice the size of the Earth that were located in habitable zones, by which I mean that area around a star where the temperature allows, if the atmosphere of the planet is right, for water to exist on the planet in ice, liquid, and gas. It's at the triple point of water. Now, we have Mars also theoretically in the habitable zone, Venus, but these two worlds have chosen very different paths toward becoming not good places to live. Venus kept all of its atmosphere, said mine, 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 and then made it poisonous. Mars was like, be free, atmosphere. It left its atmosphere go away, and without an atmosphere, it also like lost all of its water and things like that above the surface. There's water locked down in the surface. So both these worlds chose different paths towards non-habitability while existing at some place that, given the correct atmosphere, given the correct magnetic field, these worlds receive just the right amount of sunlight that they could have regions at this triple point of water.
And actually, in January of 2021, a new study of TRAPPIST-1 was published that found that its planets have very similar densities and makeups to each other, but possibly very different from Earth. In our solar system, there is a lot of variety in planet densities. The new study has led scientists to believe that the planets have rocky surfaces and iron-rich cores. Their cores are likely smaller than Earth's, since the planets each have a mass roughly 8% less than Earth's. By combining the planetary interior models from the universities of Bern and Zurich with the planetary atmosphere models at the University of Geneva, they were able to evaluate the water content of the seven TRAPPIST-1 planets with a precision literally unprecedented for this category of planet. And these internal and atmospheric structure models show that the three inner planets of the TRAPPIST-1 system are likely to be waterless, and that the four outer planets wouldn't have more than a few percent water, possibly liquid, on their surfaces. Whether the differences between Earth and the TRAPPIST planets change the potential for life somewhere in the TRAPPIST-1 system is still unclear. We just don't know enough yet. And that's why the studies will continue. So what does the future look like in further study of this fascinating star system? I mean, there are so many more questions to be answered. Here is Sarah Seeger, professor of planetary science and physics at MIT Cambridge, at the NASA press conference in February 2017.
One of the reasons astronomers are so excited about it is it's a veritable laboratory for studying planets orbiting very cool, very small, very dim red stars that are so incredibly different from our sun. In fact, astronomers constantly go back and forth about all the excitement about these worlds because they're very easy to study. Other people have fears and concerns, and so we actually get to test many people's theories about these worlds being tidally locked and radiation from the host star and things like that. So hopefully we're counting on Speculoos to find more of these systems and planets around these ultra-cool dwarfs, these very common stars that we can study. So in addition to the Speculoos, in astronomy, when someone makes a discovery like this, we put almost any telescope that can follow up to follow up. And so in that way, we have, we heard about Hubble already from Nicole, but the Hubble, Kepler K2, Spitzer, and other telescopes are exploring the TRAPPIST system further. I'd say that what the team is most excited about, although this is still a bit in the future, is the James Webb Space Telescope. Because with this telescope, and the reason the TRAPPIST planets are so significant, is that they are accessible to observations with the James Webb Space Telescope. So with the James Webb, we'll be able to study the atmospheres, and we will try to assess the greenhouse gas content, which will help us understand the surface temperature of the planets. Are they indeed the right temperature to support liquid water and life as we know it? In fact, we're even going to use the James Webb to search for gases that don't belong that might be produced by life, such as oxygen, ozone, methane, and a whole host of other gases.
To me, looking from the point of view of NASA science program, it's exciting because it's a leap forward, but it goes in parallel to the other leaps we're taking right now. Look at what's happening at Mars, where we're really looking at the complex chemistry that's happening there. Look at the recognition that Mars actually is a place where there not only used to be water, but there's water today, abundant water. In parallel to that, the recognition that we can now have the technology ability of going to Europa and actually looking at that system, which is in its own right really an exciting system because there's an ocean world there that hits the rock at the bottom in a really unexpected place in a site. There's many other places like that. And then on the theory side, we already heard that kind of the really understanding of the biology of life, kind of there's a tremendous amount of progress. So together, these areas really create kind of a crescendo towards that, really answering that question that has been on our minds for so long. This is the right time to ask that question. It is the right time to have this discovery right now.
A yellow dwarf-sized thank you to senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute, Dr. Pamela Gay, and publisher of Universe Today, Fraser Kane, for allowing me to use portions of their wonderful astronomy podcast called Astronomy Cast. If you appreciate space and science, this is definitely a podcast that's worth adding to your playlist. You can find Astronomy Cast at the same place you're listening to this, at there.com and YouTube. So what do you think? Had you heard of TRAPPIST-1 before today? Have you Googled already to take a look at the artist's conceptions of the planets yet? Are you excited about all the exoplanet discoveries? I'd love to know. My email is studio@sonicembassy.com. You can also find the Sonic Embassy on Twitter, Vero, Facebook, Patreon, and IG. Our website, sonicembassy.com. Some great resources to check out besides your favorite search engine are exoplanets.nasa.gov, ESO.org, exoplanet.eu, JW.org, EarthSky.org, and TRAPPIST.ONE. If you enjoyed this episode, share it so more people can find out about us. But if you think this podcast was not worth further observation, well, you should share that on social media with the link to sonicembassy.com/podcast. That would really show me. If you have an idea that you think would make a great episode, then let me know. Thank you so much for listening. I love you, and I hope you'll listen more. Hey, there's another episode of Milky Way Marvels in the works, so follow the Sonic Embassy to stay up to date.
音速使馆
Embajada de Sonic
Embassy.